This is a recording of the Michael Lerner teleconference with Common Wheel on July 20th, 2006 at 11 a.m. Central Time.
Decided to do a different format, and we actually got many, many questions on the blog, which I'd like to encourage people to do, but we will have an open Q&A, and as I'll go over in my instructions, we will have, there are opportunities on the blog, on the live web blog called the blog, where we are taking questions and comments, and it's actually working out really well because a lot of folks don't get to ask questions on the call because there's just a lot of, it's difficult to get airtime sometimes when a lot of people are trying to ask questions. So if you would like to ask questions or make a comment, if you visit our homepage, healthandenvironment.org, on the left side there's a What's New box, and there's a click on the very first item which is relevant to today's call, and it'll take you to the page that includes the blog. But I will go over that again. And just to let folks know, this is a new announcement. We are actually, the Collaborative on Health and the Environment is hosting a national conference, and it's a hold-the-date announcement for Friday, October 13th, 2006. It's going to be in San Francisco at the University of California at San Francisco, and we will be sending out more details over the next month or so as we configure the agenda and so forth. So hold the date, October 13th. And the other thing I wanted to mention is we have a brand new partner, CHE Partner Spotlight, on the homepage of our website with featuring Dr. Linda Judice. She is the professor and chair of the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at UC San Francisco. And she is also the founder of the new program on reproductive health and the environment at UCSF. And she's also the co-director of the CHE Fertility and Early Pregnancy Compromise Working Group Summit. It's co-sponsored with UCSF, and that's happening in January 2007, and there's a new spotlight on her. And I want to thank Allison Carlson. She has been instrumental as the lead co-coordinator of the Fertility Working Group in engaging Dr. Linda Judice and other fertility folks. It's been a really terrific progress that they've made over the last 2 years. So we are at 9:03, so I would like to begin. I'd like to ask the operator to make sure that everyone except for the speakers is placed in listen-only mode. And can you let me know if that's done?
Certainly, we will do it right now. It'll be just one moment.
Good afternoon. Healthy School.
Okay. All lines are now muted.
Okay. Thank you. So can folks hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the call. My name is Eleni Sotos. I'm the National Coordinator of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Today's teleconference is titled Human Metabolism, Diabetes, and Obesity, the Environmental Connections. The moderator for this call will be Steve Heilig. He is the Director of Public Health and Education for the San Francisco Medical Society and the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Please note that we have some useful resources available today on the CHE website pertaining to the call. We have a live blog and online resources relevant to today's topic. The live blog is available for call participants to post comments and questions during the call. No special software other than a connection to the Internet is required. And CHE staff are monitoring the blog so that we can reflect your questions and comments at the Q&A period in the second half of the call. If you'd like to access the blog and the online resources, visit our website. It's www.healthandenvironment.org. On the left-hand side, under the What's New box, click on the first link, which references today's call, and that will take you to the page containing the blog and the resources. Before we begin, I'd like to cover some quick, important logistical information. Please note that everyone on the call, with the exception of our guest speakers, has been placed in listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentations, the operator will unmute all of the lines so that you may participate in the Q&A period, if you choose. To be mindful of the process and to allow as many people to ask questions as possible, please please keep your comments and questions brief, and please identify yourself before you speak. The call is going to last 1 hour. It is being recorded, and an audio MP3 file will be available for download on the CHE website over the next 2 days. Please note that we will not have a partnership call in August, but we will be sending out details on the September partnership call over the coming weeks. I'd now like to turn the call over to Steve, but before I do that, I just want to, for folks that may not have heard me, I just want to announce a hold the date for our, CHE is having a national conference in San Francisco on Friday, October 13th at the University of California, San Francisco, so more details will follow, but we wanted to announce a hold the date. Steve?
mentioned, there are some background materials on our site for this call, and they are primarily a couple of previous calls we have done, one from 2004 related to overweight and obesity, and another one from just a few months ago, a very popular call on 10 years after our stolen future about endocrine disruptors. And in some ways, we thought of this as something of a follow-up to those, but to highlight some more specific topics related to environmental factors and metabolism. And this topic is probably, even more than any of others we have done, a very multifactorial issue, and we are here really trying to throw in perhaps a couple more issues that have not been highlighted in the various unfolding debate about metabolism, diabetes, and obesity. So we start often with a science update, and we have asked Dr. Pete Myers of Environmental Health Sciences to start us off today with an update related to today's topic. So, Pete, please go ahead.
Thank you, Steve. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Excellent. I'd like to draw your attention to a paper that's just appeared within the last week in the International Journal of Obesity by Keith et al., a collection of 10 authors from a wide array of academic laboratories. The article questions the virtual exclusive focus of the public health community on what they call the big two causes of obesity, reduced physical activity and increased caloric intake. They don't argue that these aren't possibly involved, but they do conclude that the evidence for both of them is both equivocal and largely circumstantial. They then go on to review briefly 10 additional explanations that have been proposed and go over, again briefly, its purported mechanisms and the relevant data. Among the 10 are sleep debt, endocrine disruption, increased use of air conditioners, decreased smoking, increased use of certain drugs, increased age of mothers at birth, etc. They conclude, after this review, that the roles of these 10 additional explanations are as plausible as the big two and deserve more attention and study. They also point out that the explanation of the obesity epidemic, if there is one or multiple interacting ones, will have to ultimately explain why the obesity epidemic hasn't been just an increase in the average weight, but instead an increasing skewing of the weight distribution curve so that there are more people at the right end, the heavier end of the curve, and it's becoming increasingly skewed. So with that brief note, I'll turn the program back to Steve. And I can, if you want the reference, it's in the International Journal of Obesity, published by the Nature Working Group. And I'll post there is a link on Environmental Health News in the center column.
Thank you very much, Pete. And of course, we always repeat, but Environmental Health News, if anybody is new to this, is Pete's really invaluable service, gleaning all of the news that comes out in both the public and scientific literature. So, obviously a very timely call, and let's turn it now to our featured presentations, starting with Dr. Ted Shetler, the Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. Ted.
Thanks, Steve. Good morning. I'm going to just take a few minutes to briefly give an overview of diabetes and its relation to obesity and talk a little bit about some environmental contributors. Some of this will be well known to most of you, but just a quick review. That there are two general kinds of diabetes, type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is often called insulin-dependent diabetes. It used to be called juvenile onset diabetes, and it's the result of an autoimmune destruction of the beta cells of the pancreas, the beta cells being those that produce insulin. Type 2 diabetes used to generally appear after the age of 40, and therefore had the now obsolete name of adult onset type diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is the most common metabolic disease in the world. In the U.S., it's the leading cause of blindness, end-stage kidney disease, and non-traumatic loss of limbs from vascular disease. The healthcare costs associated with type 2 diabetes exceed $130 billion annually, and it's rapidly actually becoming a global pandemic. It's likely that type 2 diabetes defects in a number of different metabolic pathways. Different tissues and organs are involved, including the pancreas, the liver, adipose tissue, skeletal muscle, and the brain. Insulin plays a major role in diabetes. Insulin, as you know, is the hormone that attaches to cell surface receptors and initiates a complex cascade of cellular events. In addition to its role in regulating glucose metabolism, insulin stimulates lipogenesis, which is the laying down of fat tissue. It diminishes the breakdown of fat tissue and increases amino acid transport into cells. Insulin also modulates gene transcription, stimulates growth, DNA synthesis, and cell replication. So type 2 diabetes ultimately results from both insulin resistance and insulin deficiency. Insulin resistance is an early feature of type 2 diabetes. Insulin levels are initially elevated, but later insulin production by the beta cells in the pancreas declines. And that decreased production results from a combination of failure to increase the number of beta cells and increasing death of beta cells. There's a strong correlation between obesity, insulin resistance, and the onset of type 2 diabetes. In the United States, more than 25% of people under 40 are obese, and that number is growing. And childhood obesity and associated type 2 diabetes is growing really at an alarming rate. It's likely that multiple genes are involved in susceptibility to type 2 diabetes. The contribution of heredity differs considerably between populations in different environments. In other words, some people are more genetically predisposed to develop diabetes than others and will be much more vulnerable to environmental factors. The dramatic rise in obesity in the U.S. has led to an equally alarming increase in the percentage of the population who suffer from what's sometimes called the metabolic syndrome. The metabolic syndrome is a clustering of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk factors, including obesity, insulin resistance, low levels of HDLs, which are the good kind of lipoproteins, and a systemic pro-inflammatory state. Although the metabolic syndrome is not exclusively associated with type 2 diabetes, the increasing prevalence of obesity and associated type 2 diabetes makes insulin resistance a really important and major contributor to metabolic syndrome. But obesity alone does not always lead to insulin resistance, because some individuals who are obese do not experience insulin resistance, and conversely, some individuals who are insulin resistant are not overweight. Now, all of the above suggests that there are multiple pathways by which a number of different environmental factors could influence the risk of type 2 diabetes. Diet, of course, is a major concern, and we know that obesity can cause diabetes beginning during development. Intrauterine factors, including nutrition, influence the risk of diabetes. Low birth weight children are at increased risk of developing diabetes later in life. This could, of course, mean that genetic factors influence both birth weight and diabetes risk. But in a group of middle-aged identical twins, only one of whom had diabetes, the diabetic twin was much more frequently the lighter one at birth, which implies that intrauterine factors influencing fetal growth may have long-term implications for metabolic health. One hypothesis suggests that genetic programming during fetal development sets the stage for development of obesity and diabetes later in life. The details of how obesity causes diabetes are not fully understood, but fat tissue is metabolically very active, secreting hormones such as leptin, mediators in inflammation, and other signaling molecules. Eventually, the pancreas is not able to keep up with the demand for insulin, and clinical diabetes develops. Exercise is also an important factor. The average American child now spends about 25 hours a week watching television. This adds up to more than 1.5 months nonstop of TV every year. And that does not include the time spent in front of a screen watching videos, playing video games, or using a computer. Aside from going to school, American children now spend more time watching television than doing anything else except sleeping. During the course of a year, the typical American child watches more than 40,000 TV commercials. About 20,000 of those ads are for junk food, soft drinks, sweets, breakfast cereals, and fast food. So we can see that diet and a sedentary lifestyle are linked. There's some other candidate environmental contributors. One is tobacco smoke. Active smokers and people exposed to environmental tobacco smoke, or so-called passive smokers, are more likely to develop diabetes. This holds true even after adjustment for socioeconomic, behavioral, and other biologic factors. And there are also some pharmaceuticals that can influence insulin resistance. But there's been considerable recent interest in the potential role of endocrine-disrupting chemicals in the pathogenesis of obesity, insulin resistance, and diabetes. And I'll just give an example. The pancreatic beta cells that produce insulin have several kinds of estrogen receptors. These include both the alpha and beta receptors, which act through the classic nuclear transcription activation, but also an estrogen receptor in the cell membrane on the surface of the cell that, when activated, causes more rapid cellular responses. So all three of these kinds of estrogen receptors are present in the beta cells of the pancreas. Now, normal levels of estrogen are thought to promote and help maintain normal beta cell function. But abnormal or elevated levels of estrogen may promote insulin resistance, similar to what is sometimes seen in pregnancies. Rodent studies show that exposure to estrogen or estrogenic agents can cause increased insulin production with minimal or no effect on blood glucose levels. This is exactly the picture that one would expect to see with insulin resistance. But besides estrogen, one chemical that has been tested in rodents was bisphenol A. Now, many of you will know this chemical. It has estrogenic properties. It's a chemical used to make polycarbonate plastic, and it's used in various kinds of coatings and dental sealants. And studies done by the Centers for Disease Control show that the general population is widely exposed to low levels of this chemical. Its remnants can actually be detected in the urine of about 95% of the population. In rodents, when the animals are injected with bisphenol A, at levels which produce a serum level similar to those in the general population, initially a rapid increase in insulin production is noticed, probably mediated through the rapidly active cell membrane estrogen receptor. Later, after several days of exposure to bisphenol A, insulin accumulates in the beta cells of the pancreas, and it appears that the classic nuclear estrogen receptor is involved now. And now, when the rats are challenged with glucose, they are shown to be relatively insulin resistant. They have abnormal rises in their glucose levels. So it appears that bisphenol A induced insulin resistance in the rodents after several days of exposure at levels that are similar to what humans are exposed to. Now, obviously, this is going on in rodents, and we don't know whether these results are relevant for humans. But the results are provocative and show that environmental contaminants can interfere with normal metabolism. There are also several cross-sectional studies in humans that show a correlation between levels of various persistent organic pollutants, such as dioxin and the metabolite of DDT. But I am not going to say more about these because I think our next speaker, David Carpenter, is going to discuss that in some more detail. So I think I'll stop with that, Steve.
Thank you very much, Ted, for that invaluable summary there. And Dr. David Carpenter is Professor of Environmental Health and Toxicology at the Institute for Health and the Environment at the State University of New York at Albany. So, Dr. Carpenter, please go ahead.
Thanks very much. What I'd like to do is tell you about two studies that we have that are looking at the relationships or possible relationships between exposure to certain pesticides and PCBs and diabetes. Neither of these studies is published yet, although the second study that I'll talk about is under a final review and will hopefully be appearing in Environmental Health Perspectives fairly shortly. The first study is one in a Native American group in northern New York State at the New York-Canadian boundary, the Mohawks that live at Akwesasne. And we have been involved in studies there over a number of years. As probably most people realize, Native Americans do have a high incidence of diabetes. But this particular group also lives just downriver from three aluminum foundries that use PCBs as hydraulic fluids. The hydraulic fluids leaked. The PCBs were washed into the St. Lawrence River and its tributaries, which were the traditional fishing grounds for the Mohawks, who were traditionally a fishing population. While after advisories were issued, the tribal leaders advised against eating a lot of local fish. Nevertheless, the people in this community still have PCB levels two or three times higher than the background in the U.S. So we have a study of 352 adults. They were between the ages of 30 and 85. And for each of these adults, we have serum PCB levels, we have levels of Myrex, hexachlorobenzene, and DDE, the major metabolite of DDT. In addition, we have fasting glucose levels. We divided the population into two groups. Those people with a diagnosis of diabetes, by which we mean that either they were currently on anti-diabetic medication, having been diagnosed as being diabetic by a physician somewhere, or they had fasting glucose levels greater than 125. And of our population, we had 71 people that were in this category of being diabetic, and 281 that we would classify as normal. Now, I'm not going to expand on that, but let me just tell you that even within that population that don't reach the diabetic criteria, we do find a relationship between their fasting glucose levels and their levels of serum PCBs and pesticides. When we compare the diabetics against the non-diabetics in terms of tertiles of contaminant levels, we find for total PCBs that the highest tertile as compared to the lowest shows an odds ratio of 3.9. That is nearly a fourfold elevated risk of diabetes. The second tertile as compared to the first shows a 2.15 odds ratio, or more than a doubling of the odds of being diabetic. We've looked at subgroups of PCBs, and of the subgroups, insofar as we know their mechanisms of action, the group that gave us the highest odds ratio were those that are the phenobarbital type inducers. These are PCBs like congener 153, which is the congener that is present in highest concentration in most of us. The odds ratio for these phenobarbital type inducers was 4.25, comparing the third tertile to the lowest. There were elevations with other groups, especially the dioxin-like congeners, whether identified as a group of congeners that have dioxin-like activity or dioxin toxic equivalents. And those odds ratios were of the order of 3.7 to 3.8. Now, among the pesticides, we found even higher odds ratios for both hexachlorobenzene and for DDE. The odds ratio for the top tertile as compared to the lowest for DDE was 6.43, whereas that for hexachlorobenzene was 6.2. Now, taken together, these results provide a fairly strong correlation between serum levels of these contaminants and risk of being diagnosed with diabetes. We can't be terribly convincing about which ones are the causative agents, assuming that there is cause and effect here. These are all fat-soluble compounds that migrate together, so it's certainly intriguing to look at those contaminants for which the odds ratios are the highest. But because the rates of metabolism of these compounds, none of them are metabolized very rapidly, but the rates of metabolism do vary. So this is a relatively inexact science. But I think our results are some of the strongest evidence to date that these persistent organic pollutants as a group are correlated with elevated risk of diabetes. Now let me turn to our second study, and this is much more of an ecologic study, where we have looked at all of the residents in New York State with the exclusion of New York City. And we have matched a couple of data sets. In New York, if you are hospitalized as an inpatient, when you are discharged, that hospital, if it's a state-regulated hospital, which is basically everything except Veterans Administration hospitals, when you're discharged, that hospital must report to the state health department every disease you have, not just the disease that caused your hospitalization. So if you go in with a broken arm and have diabetes, diabetes will be on that record. We know in publicly accessible data, we know the age, the race, the sex, and the zip code of residence of each patient that's hospitalized. Now, obviously, zip code of residence is pretty crude, but it does give us some information. We also have a data set in New York which identifies about 900 hazardous waste sites. These are national priority sites. These are state Superfund sites. And these are also areas of concern as identified by the International Joint Commission. We've looked at each of those 900 sites and identified through the available data sets which contaminants were there and where those sites were located. For each site, we've determined whether or not persistent organic pollutants are found at that site, and we've identified the zip code or zip codes that that site is located in, or in the case of a body of water, which abut that site. We have then matched the hospitalization data set against the residence zip code of the patients and looked at rates of hospitalization. Our hypothesis was and is that if one lives near to a PCB-contaminated site, that in itself poses a risk of exposure and of risk of disease. Now, if we look at all of New York State, with the exception of New York City, and look at the rates of hospitalization, we find that if you live in a zip code that contains or abuts a persistent organic polluted site, you have a greater rate of hospitalization. Our rates per 100,000, if you live in a POP zip code, is 1,725 per 100,000 people, as compared to 1,407 if you live in a zip code that does not have a waste site. The interesting thing is the elevation. If we look at the distribution as a function of age, the elevation is primarily in younger people, starting even at the 25-year-old, but particularly dramatic in the 35 to 44-year age group or the 45 to 54. And by the time you get to the really older people, it isn't quite as dramatic. Now, as was clearly stated by Pete in the beginning of this conference, there are many other risk factors. We're certainly not saying that exposure to environmental contaminants are the only risk factor. And it's very difficult using the kind of data we have available to control for all of those. But the risks that are obvious are race, socioeconomic status, diet, exercise, smoking, variety of things like that. Well, we've used a linear regression model controlling for some of the variables, age, sex, race, and we find that the risk ratio for living in a persistent organic polluted zip code as compared to a clean zip code, that zip code that doesn't have any waste site, is 1.19, or a 19% increase in risk. Now, if you live in a zip code that has a waste site but it does not have persistent organics, with this modeling, we also find a statistically significant elevation there with a rate ratio of 1.16. Now, that doesn't control for a lot of things like socioeconomic class, smoking, diet, and exercise. And we don't really have good control over that, but we have one population of 78 zip codes of those persons that live along the Hudson River, which is actually visible outside my office window. The Hudson River is 200 miles of a PCB-contaminated Superfund site from releases from two General Electric plants 200 miles north of Manhattan. And the people that live along the Hudson in general have higher incomes. Using the behavioral risk factor surveillance system, they smoke less, they eat more fruits and vegetables, and they exercise more, which are surrogate measures for obesity. And so we looked at this population as at least a partial control for these traditional risk factors for diabetes. If exposure is the factor, we would not expect the risk rate to be lower. If other factors, if behavioral factors explain the diabetes in the full population in New York, then we would expect a significantly lower risk ratio. What we find is a risk ratio of 1.32, significantly greater than that for the whole of New York State, in contrast to a risk ratio of 1.17 for the other waste sites as compared to the clean sites, which then would have a risk ratio of 1. We think that these two studies together, one with good exposure assessment, measurement of PCBs, the other with large numbers, many, many people, but with very poor exposure assessment. Together, they provide strong evidence for there being a relationship between exposure and diabetes. Another important conclusion is that we hypothesize that the major route of exposure from simply living near a waste site is you're breathing in PCBs from the air, either vapor phase PCBs or particulate-bound PCBs. Just living near a waste site doesn't mean you eat contaminated fish, which is usually thought of as being the most important route of exposure. So in conclusion, we believe our results provide strong evidence that certain classes of environmental contaminants can increase risk of diabetes. These have been neglected. They're not understood by the public. They're not understood by the medical community. And these are some of the factors that need to be considered in trying to understand the multiple factors that contribute to the risk of diabetes. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Carpenter. And we'll turn now to Dr. Gary Ferguson, who is the wellness coordinator with the Eastern Aleutian Tribes in Alaska and has had a special focus on diabetes in this population where it has been increasing very rapidly. Dr. Ferguson.
Yes, thank you. The Aleut population, which I've been working with over the past 5 years, has experienced the largest increase in prevalence in the past 10 years, over 106% increase, which is actually the largest for any Alaska Native population in the state of Alaska. And the state of Alaska leads the nation in the greatest percent increase in prevalence of diabetes. So, you know, we're looking at a population that has had a huge change in this disease status. And so as we look at prevention and outreach, that's been my focus. As has been stated this morning, it's a multifactorial etiology in most populations, and I really see that in this population as well. You know, first of all, the Aleut population had the first contact with the outside, the Russians, in around 1750. And since then, we've seen a tremendous change in diet, giving up the nutrient-dense foods for processed foods from berries and fish and sea mammals to highly processed foods such as Pilot Boy crackers, peanut butter that has trans fats in it, which, you know, both of those have been known to be connected to the metabolic syndrome and to impaired fasting glucose and obesity. Kelp, seaweeds, organ meats high in vitamins and nutrients, and the roots and greens have not often been substituted for a similar counterpart in food once we've become a cash economy and been living out of the store, as many of us do now. Weston Price, who was a dentist that did a bunch of research with the Yupiks, which are our natives to the north, really saw a big connection between a change in diet from a traditional diet to one that's been highly refined in sugars and in low in fiber as being connected to a change in health, and namely diabetes and changes in dentition is what he found. Of course, we've changed our activities. We've become more land dwellers with land jobs rather than hunter-gatherers, and so that's a change in activity as well. And so we're really working with our population on, you know, increasing activity to try to prevent obesity. We've seen a change in economy as well, which we're a fishing industry primarily in the Aleutians, and fishing has gone downhill as far as the stock as well as the price. And so we've seen a change in the demographics of folks as far as what people are able to afford in the store, rather than buying out of the lower 48 Seattle. We used to ship our foods up. Now we buy out of the store kind of on a weekly basis, which what's available at the store is highly processed foods most often. And so folks are kind of really changing it due to economy as well as far as their intake of foods that are low in nutrients. We've also seen changes as far as the alcohol was introduced by the Russians, and we do see an increased a change as far as alcoholism. And, of course, from my perspective as a naturopathic doctor, alcohol is fire water, and with diabetes, there's a correlation between those that are abusers of alcohol to diabetes. Of course, we see that in all populations, but it's one of those where in the native population it was not a traditionally available, so there's definitely a change there. Of course, it's also been noticed and talked about is the high rate of tobacco abuse in our populations, and specifically Alaska Natives. We're seeing 40 to 50% of our Alaska Natives still smoking and or chewing, but in our population it's primarily smoking. And the diabetes insulin resistance with tobacco smoke is well documented now. With the new Surgeon General's report, you know, we're looking at tobacco as a prime contributor to some of our insulin resistance. And of course, you know, the big health disparity with tobacco, we're trying to address that as well as far as changing the social norms. What is interesting as far as we look at the environmental impact is the Aleutians were part of the Thousand Mile War, quote unquote, in World War II. The Aleutian campaign had hundreds of thousands of troops in the Aleutians, and we saw the Aleut evacuation. The Aleuts were also a very stressed population due to World War II. A lot of them were displaced and sent to Southeast Alaska or the Northwest, and we're seeing the stress aspect of diabetes and cultural, historical stress also being a contributor to some of the diseases that the Aleuts face. However, the connection with hazardous waste hasn't been completely put together as far as 1+1 yet, but as the talk today was really highlighting, there's a high correlation between exposure to toxic wastes and diabetes. And Amchitka, which is one of the Aleutian Islands, there was nuclear radiation exposure, and of course now they're doing reparation to those that served in cleaning it up because of the high risk of cancer and diabetes and other diseases. Cold Bay and other military sites also they're continuing to clean it up even as we speak. The question has been often as far as are traditional foods still healthy and should we advocate for our Alaska Native population to eat traditional foods? And Jennifer Johnson and others at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium and the Health Board, you know, the research that they've done most recently show that the benefits still outweigh the risks at this point anyway as far as in the traditional foods, just due to the fact that often due to economic factors we can't buy a healthier counterpart that, you know, in the oceans and on the land around us we see traditional foods that are still very high in nutrients and relatively safe. However, in Alaska and other communities that have canneries and a lot of processing going on, there's warning signs, do not eat the shellfish. And Alaska Natives that I speak with in those communities say, you know, we can't eat our traditional foods because they're toxic. And so that is an increasing challenge as we look at, you know, Alaska being a place where a lot of companies have set up and environmental legislation has been lax. You know, in summary, the Aleut population, you know, have been known across the state to be the masters of adaptation. We've had multiple influences as far as different cultures coming in, and either the fishing industry or the mining industry, and the Aleut population have thrived and adapted well. However, they're challenged currently with some of our communities having up to 50%. Of our population with either impaired fasting glucose or type 2 diabetes. So we're looking at a challenge that we're facing that, you know, could decimate certain communities. in the future, and that's where we're looking at how do we prevent this. And, of course, looking at the multifactorial nature of this challenge, we're going to have to really put our thinking caps on to address all of these issues. I want to conclude with naturopathic medicine, we have the concept of vis medicatrix naturae, which is the healing power of nature and the body's own inherent healing wisdom. And our bodies are amazing as far as their ability to detoxify when given the right resources and the ability to deal with an environment that sometimes can be toxic. And the Aleut population, the way that I look at them is in their rising prevalence of diabetes is kind of a canary of sorts where, you know, they're showing signs of this disease. And it's, of course, indicative of all of us. We're all going to be facing that. But addressing it, I think, as we start to look at this population, is definitely going to be key to all of our survival and ability to meet this challenge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've let, actually, our speakers go a little longer than we usually do here because it's such a complex issue. And we have a few questions on the blog here. I will note that Pete Myers has posted the bisphenol A study that Dr. Shetler mentioned. And we do have one question. I think, Ted, you mentioned this a little bit, but gestational diabetes and environmental connections. Is there anything you want to highlight about that?
No, that is, I don't know of an environmental connection that's special to gestational diabetes. It's just that the hormonal milieu during pregnancy changes quite dramatically. And with the changes in estrogen level, a relative insulin resistance becomes apparent in some women that then subsides after giving birth, although it may be a harbinger of a susceptibility to type 2 diabetes that will surface later in life. But I don't have any special information about environmental susceptibility during pregnancy.
All right, and there's another question here related to body weight and BMI, a study in Mohawk people and PCB. Do our speakers have any comment on that, knowledge of that?
Well, there certainly is a relationship between both PCB levels and obesity and diabetes, but we have in our models controlled for body mass index. So the relationship we're seeing between exposure and risk of diabetes is not simply explained by obesity or overweight.
Right. Do we want to now unmute people for questioning, Eleni?
Yes. So, operator, if you could please go ahead and let us know when that's done, I'd appreciate it.
And is Phil Lee on here today? Dr. Chairman of...
We should find out once everyone is unmuted.
All lines are being opened now.
Thank you. And, Steve, I just would like to note there is a question from Chay partner Dr. Jack Weiss.
We did that one.
He asks, please address the environmental connections with gestational diabetes.
We just addressed that one. Like,
okay, you got it. Thank you.
So do we have other...
All the lines are now open.
Oh, Steve, this is Phil Lee.
Hello, Phil. Dr. Phil Lee, Chair of CHE, and I thought he might have a comment for us today.
Well, I was going to ask, one of the questions has to do with really public policy and how... I have some ideas about that, but the... One of my friends has described this situation as a perfect storm. The policies promote these horrible dietary practices that we now see. And also, on the other hand, we have policies that promote the payment for drugs and operations to treat these. I mean, the most, you know, ridiculous, some of these. Same time, very little policy focused on prevention and particularly dealing with the kind of environmental issues that we've talked about. And I'd just like to get comments from anyone about this. And I had also a tiny question for Ted about some years ago, Norm Kretschmer, who used to be the head of pediatrics at Stanford and then the head of the Institute of Child Health, did a lot of work on overweight babies and diabetes. And I was a little surprised to hear that underweight babies are now more likely to get diabetes.
Well, I think my understanding of what I've read on this is I agree. Overweight babies are at risk for being overweight in adulthood and therefore at risk of type 2 diabetes. I think that's right. But low birth weight is also a risk for subsequent overweight. through some fetal programming mechanism in all likelihood. So I think both ends of the weight spectrum put you at risk for overweight.
What do you think, Ted, about policies? Have you got any thoughts about that? Thinking about these things?
I'd love to have your thoughts on them, Phil, but I will just comment that I was just this morning reading in Science Magazine a new policy that is being instituted in New York City for surveillance of A1C hemoglobin levels, which are a marker for how well your diabetes or your blood sugar is being controlled in people who are diabetic in New York, because of the recognition that we are doing horrible surveillance and control of blood sugars in diabetics is not good, and we are heading into a real public health emergency. And it's a very interesting article. It's in, I think, this week's Science, because of the objections from people who are with a strong libertarian streak, who say, you know, this is an individual health matter. Individual health should not be confused with public health. Despite that, there are going to be some pilots to try this in some neighborhoods in Queens, but that's an interesting issue about how people sometimes object to a public health response to these kinds of things. But
Ted, you don't have to be a libertarian to have some concerns, particularly with respect to the privacy of the individuals whose information is being disclosed in ways that they may not have given permission. And, you know, how far do you stretch it? I mean, you could call everything an epidemic. Practically, we call everything in health a crisis. So I think we have to look at that one very carefully, not just from that, you know, libertarian point of view.
Hello?
Okay, do we have another question here?
Yes. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Marion Feinberg from New York, from the Bronx. I just wanted to just follow up for a second on the New York City issue and then ask a question. I mean, part of the problem here in New York is, so they collect the information, then what are they going to do with it? Is it going to be actually used to help the people who are being reported or not? I mean, the way the New York City Department of Health recently instituted a program where reported to have gestational diabetes are being followed up with a letter advising them to exercise more and eat healthy food, which is to most of our way of thinking about public health and not really a very good intervention. It's not sitting down with a nutritionist or a doctor or a nurse practitioner or someone who could, or support, or anybody who could actually help people make real changes in their lives. So,
right, that sounds like
what doubts about the Department of Health and how useful this data is going to be in terms of helping with clinical changes of people.
Sounds like maybe Dr. Carpenter might respond to that about useful interventions.
But as to my question, which I had actually sent yesterday to Julia, but here in the South Bronx, we sort of face a polluted environment, but we also face a built environment that's very conducive to unhealthy behaviors in terms of scarcity of fresh food and scarcity of places to exercise, et cetera. And I know that in the studies, people tend to want to, adjust for those things rather than to, like, look at synergisms between, in this case, the built environment and actual exposure to environmental chemicals that are obesity. And so I was wondering if there was a comment about that, about synergism, and how we might start to look at that.
Well, let me try to answer both. I think in terms of the last point, there needs to be much more attention to synergistic interactions in disease. And that's not just synergistic interactions of more than one chemical, but interactions between socioeconomic status, between stress of life and exposures and the density of population in the urban environment. So those really are all important issues, and they receive altogether too little attention. But to go back to some of the earlier discussion, I think we're caught in a bind here with collection of information which is not used. I've personally had great difficulty getting information from our state health department. Why are we collecting all this information if it's not going to be available for use? In my own judgment, I think we've gone overboard on the issue of trying to protect confidential information. There's a matter of protecting of the individual, which certainly is important, but we've gotten to the point where we don't protect society because we do not do adequate surveillance. This is an issue that's not going to be resolved on this call, but it's an issue that does deserve debate on how to balance the protection of individual rights versus how to protect society by getting information on causes of disease.
Thank you. Do we have another question here?
Yes, I have a question here.
Could you state your name, please?
Yeah, this is Dr. Roy Ozan, and this is based just from my experience as a practitioner for 30 years. When we are in a state of health, our body maintains homeostasis. And we do all this research looking at either asthma or diabetes, and these are all manifestations of the fact that people are slipping into chronic disease states or they can't maintain homeostasis. Research, I think, would do well to look at the question not in individual disease, but let's focus on what factors are tipping people into chronic disease, non-homeostatic states, and not because you miss stuff. If you do all this work and you're only looking at blood sugar, so we need to start using indexes that look at homeostasis abilities in a broad variety of ways, because you can see one disease morph into another. If you use treatments that put pressure on the blood sugar, they can slip into asthma, they can slip into cancer, they can go back and forth. It's really a question about chronic disease, not individual, so much individual diseases. The second comment is that we are missing one other factor that I see tip people into chronic disease, and sometimes that will be diabetes, and that is our medical treatments of people. Vaccinations, steroid use for skin eruptions, many treatments like that, antibiotics for earaches. You follow people after these treatments, you will see the eruption, the manifestation of chronic, serious chronic diseases coming after these symptomatic treatments.
All right, thank you. We'd like to go to, is there another question for our speaker?
This is Tony Temple, Ohio Network. I have a question. I think Dr. Carpenter mentioned the two studies on the PCBs, pesticides, and diabetes. Does anyone know which components of the pesticides are seen as being responsible for this endocrine disruption? I personally have had experience with copper contained in the pesticides, and I wonder if there's a link to the heavy metals here.
Well, in our study, we did not monitor for metals, so I really can't answer it on the basis of the study. But I think the point you make is a good one, that we really have not investigated many different environmental contaminants in relation to diabetes. There's information on dioxin from the Agent Orange spraying in Vietnam, and little other information. It all needs to be done.
We have a question on our blog here from Bruce Blumberg at University of California, Irvine, related to organotin content in contaminated sites described by Dr. Carpenter or in the populations, and the link between chemicals and fat development. Is there any...
was that organotins? Is that the question?
Yes.
Well, again, organotins would have fallen in our other waste category. In our model, the elevated risk of diabetes was almost as great for these other waste sites, which can have a variety of metals, can have volatile organics, can have ionizing radiation, as it was for our persistent organic contaminated sites. So, again, it's a lack of information, but certainly an area that deserves more investigation.
And Dr. Blumberg notes that mice studies that they have done have shown weight gain in prenatal exposure as well.
Yeah, Steve, I would add to that you referenced at the beginning that the notes from the call that Che had on obesity are on the website, and some of that material was discussed then. So these links between obesity and then diabetes are probably coming up here in people's minds.
All right. And Dr. Carpenter, another question from here is the paper regarding PCB, diabetes, and waste sites. Is that, where will it be published?
Well, it will be in Environmental Health Perspectives. We have a very positive review. We're probably later this week being sending it back to the journal. I'm pretty confident it will be accepted.
Thank you. Do we have another question for our speakers? Please be succinct.
This is Lynn Cannon from the Learning Disabilities Association. And many of the environmental causative factors that have been attributed to diabetes have also been attributed to learning and related disorders. And I wondered if any work had been done on the incidence of learning disorders correlated with the increased rate of diabetes and other metabolic diseases.
Link between diabetes and learning disorders. Any comments on that from our speakers?
Well, there certainly is strong evidence that learning disabilities are increased in individuals exposed to PCBs and pesticides. I'm not aware, most of the learning studies have been done in children or adolescents rather than adults. And I'm not aware of any study that's looked specifically in the same population at both. But since the same agents cause both effects, it wouldn't be surprising if there were relationships there.
I think the thing I would add is that it points out that environmental contaminants often will have an impact on various tissues and biological mechanisms within manifestations that may show up in different either sites in the body or different organ systems or different phenotypic disease.
This is probably a question that would be addressed as part of the National Children's Study.
Do we have another question for our speakers, please?
Hello?
Hello.
Okay, since no one else is speaking.
No, you go right ahead.
This is Liberty Goodwin. I'm the director of the Toxics Information Project TIP in Providence, Rhode Island.
Okay.
I am just wondering whether anyone has looked for or found any connections with diabetes and RGBH, bovine growth hormone.
Diabetes and bovine growth hormone.
Mm-hmm. I think that I have read of some possible connections with obesity as a result of these hormones, in meat.
Ed, have you read anything about
that? No, I don't have anything to add to that.
Yeah.
Okay. It's because we're talking about, the effects of hormones and endocrine disruptors.
I think one of the important points is that these compounds induce many, many different genes, especially in the liver. And there's a lot of evidence that genes related to gluconeogenesis are among those induced by PCBs, dioxins, and pesticides. So there's a variety of mechanisms that could be responsible for the effects we see, and much more work needs to be done to try to get at genetic and other exposures. Other hormones, of course, also induce or repress genes. So this is a fertile area for new investigation.
Mm-hmm.
We have time for another question. Anybody else?
I have a question for Dr. Carpenter. This is Kathy Burns. The recent Supreme Court decision regarding Illinois' release of cancer data and the requirement to do that is something that doesn't seem to be followed up at the state level in other locations. Is this something that you think people should pursue, those of us who work with this kind of data on epidemiology or other things? Do you have any suggestions about how we can do that in a collaborative way to be more effective?
Well, the short answer is yes, this is something that everybody that's concerned for public health should pursue, in my judgment. And again, it's not that there's a black and white answer. We have a huge data that's being collected by health departments, both in state and federal governments. And the challenge is to make that data accessible to qualified investigators without compromising the confidentiality of human subjects. And there's got to be ways of doing this. What we're seeing is increasingly collecting huge amounts of data that nobody is allowed to even get access to. That's a waste of time and money, and it's not in the best interest of public health. But I don't mean to minimize the issues of protecting individual rights, but there is a greater good that is got to be considered here as well. And at the moment, we don't have well-defined, clear guidelines, so everybody's sort of going their own way. We're going to see more and more of these issues that are dealt with at a state level. And I certainly think it's important that we get a national policy that protects individual rights but still makes data that's so important for understanding the disease incidence in the population accessible to qualified investigators.
Thank you very much. We are going to wind up here, and thanks so much to our speakers who did a wonderful job on this complex topic. I want to mention just one resource that I'm very enthusiastic about that Ted had mentioned, the media environment and advertising, and Eric Schlosser, the famous author of Fast Food Nation, has a brand new book out called Chew on This, Everything You Don't Want to Know About Fast Food. The great thing about it is a kid's book about junk food. It's just published by Houghton Mifflin. I've just done a review of it, and it's really quite good in a educational and preventive state. So thank you again. I'm going to turn it back to Eleni to wind up, and we will talk to all of you again soon.
Thanks, Steve. Just two quick announcements. Well, first, I'd like to thank all the speakers and everyone who posed questions on the blog as well as in the Q&A session. Two quick things. We will not have a partnership call in August, and we will have one in September, so stay tuned for those details. And secondly, I want to announce our national conference. It is going to be happening in San Francisco at UC, University of California, on Friday, October 13th. So hold the date. Thanks, everyone. Have a great August, and we look forward to talking with you in September. Bye.
Thank you all.